This is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Minnick.
I'm John Cruz.
And I'm Chris Palmer.
And Mike Beetz is in an airport somewhere. We tried to get him, and he told us it's probably too noisy where he is for him to participate. But it's been so long, we felt we should do it without him. And so we'll just talk about Mike for the most of the podcast. But I wanted to start off talking about NDCA, which we were all at. I mean, last week, Beetz and I were in the Tab room together. John, what were you? You were sort of like, you were at the ballot table.
Yes. And the NDCA board members aren't allowed to be in the Tab room for, issues of impartiality and whatnot.
Okay, well.
So sort of, which I think makes sense. I mean, I think it makes total sense.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we had three people. Kaz was in there in the LD, and we did PF and LD both. And Mr. Palmer judged a couple of rounds.
Yeah, about 87 of them. Yes.
This was. I want to say, and I've said this on my blog, and I want to say it again here. We tried hard to get judges. I think there is a perception that maybe we didn't try hard, and or that NDCA is more biased towards policy or something like that. But going back to the beginning, John had provided us.
Yes.
Had provided us with a lot of judges. And Tim Mahoney, who was the tournament director, really tried to get these people, and they were, and we couldn't get people. And then he and I tried to get some more people, and everybody seemed to have a perfectly reasonable excuse for not showing up. It was this weekend, or they were away, or
finals
and things like that. So it was really hard to get people. So any perception that anybody listening to this might have that, they just don't care about LD, it's absolutely not true. I mean, we have some ideas that might help next time ensuring getting the judges, but the problem was, that being said, we had a fairly small pool of judges, which is why Chris had to judge virtually every round, if not literally every round.
I had one round off. But
yeah. Half a round, right? Because didn't I throw you into something in the B flight?
No.
Oh, that's right. You had the last round off. That's right.
I gave you
the last round.
So we could actually go to dinner.
Yeah, so we go eat. But that was different.
Yeah. work of a different kind, yes.
But, so we're using mutual judge preferences in a very small pool. It was hard. I mean, it was very, very hard to get mutuality for maybe a quarter of the field in any particular round, just because of the way people prep. I mean, there's always a couple of people that just prep totally different than everybody else. And one of the things I did, and I just put this out there, what we did, we had a whiteboard, in the room. And we knew early on that we weren't going to be able to give mutuality every time. Now, we talked to tournament director and said, okay, it is mutuality first, and then, one, two, two, three, whatever, as after we've exhausted every possibility of mutuality down to 3-3. And he agreed with that. We had this other thing, which we had done at the Bronx, and I think we should continue to do this in the future, is allow people to give a preference between, I'd rather have be at the bottom of a 2-1 than get a 3-3 or a 4-4. Kind of thing. And I think we should allow people to do that, but it was too late here. But what we did anyhow, we had the whiteboard. And so every time somebody got at the bottom of a 1-2, and it was usually just 1-2s, it hardly ever went in further than that. If somebody got at the bottom of a 1-2, we gave them, okay, they got screwed, so we put them on the negative side. And whoever had gotten the plus on the 1-2 went on the positive side. And we kept track of everybody so that when the next round came, we didn't do it again. We switched it around. So we would try to erase things to try to keep them as even as possible, at least over the span of the tournament. Now, we couldn't do it perfectly, but we were able to do some of it. So I think that helped a little bit. But the other thing, and I had pointed this out on my blog, I really seriously question how much not getting your preferred judge had anything to do with the result of any particular round. It just means you didn't get your judge. It doesn't mean that you lost the round. Oh, I got the 2. I lost the round. I can go home now. That did not seem to happen at all. We had a couple of people that were screwed. It seemed over and over again. We try to fix it, and then they get screwed again. And they kept winning anyhow. I mean, these were people who were undefeated. We had I wonder. I just bring this up. I don't know where it goes or anything, but how important the whole preferencing thing is within the range of a 1 and a 2, something like that.
Well, at a tournament like NDCA, too, I think that the preferences were largely the same, because really what you're after in a pool like that is quality of judge, not so much how much they agree with how you debate.
Mm-hmm.
I think the kids are mostly aiming for people that they know, and they know that who would do it, how to adapt to, and they're familiar with. I mean, we were rating people as ones that would not be ones in a very deep pool, but because it was a shallow pool for the reasons you talked about, they were ones because I knew who they were, and I at least knew I had an idea of how to strike at them.
Yeah.
And so in that kind of a situation, I don't think it's really all that big a deal when it comes down to preferences as such, because really what you're getting is you're getting community ratings, and they're just multiplied by a number of people.
Yeah, you know? I think it does boil down to sort of, these are the judges. We had this a couple of times. I would have given this person this, like somebody was undefeated, and I remember this very distinctly. Someone was undefeated, and they got a 4-4. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, if this were, and I forget, it was deep into the tournament, too, so there's no question these people are going to break. And I was thinking, you know, if this were just a tournament where we didn't have prefs, that person, that same judge would have been in there, because I don't, you know, that those people are fine. I mean, I need these judges somewhere. I need the stronger judges in the rounds where people might not break. You know, so I have to put this person here. I can't, you know, I certainly don't want to put that person into a round where somebody's on the bubble and all the other people are taken. You know, I mean, there's just so much you can do.
What was the placement rules in terms of who gets who gets paired first?
Okay, it changed after every, I mean, obviously it's random in the beginning, but after, on the third round, it went to the undefeateds got the preferences first, and then the down ones, and then the down twos. And if I'm not mistaken, in the fourth round, it was the down ones, the undefeateds, and then the down twos, and then the down twos took preference after that, which I wouldn't have done personally. I would always start with the down twos as getting the preferred judges. So, and this is something
threes?
Partially because it was, I'm thinking in terms of seven
the
rounds.
The rules were written for 7 rounds.
Yeah, but whatever the round is where if you lose it, you're out, that would be the first round. Yeah, I agree. That would be
I'm sorry to interrupt. The only reason I mentioned that is that I'm a little embarrassed to put this on the public record that I can't remember exactly what the rationale was, because the board voted on this a while ago.
Yeah.
But Jenny Height from Westminster made a really interesting, if I recall, it was Jenny Hyde, really interesting justification for why that system was used. At some point I'll find it, and then maybe we can talk about that in a future episode too.
I mean,
did we just lose Chris Palmer?
Did we?
Chris?
We might have. He's gone. Let me go back to okay, those of you listening in our home,
we're experiencing technical difficulties.
Well, not so much that we're going to stop and, like, he's still on here. Well,
okay, I was watching The Empire Strikes Back today.
His internet came out. Let's try this. You were what?
I was watching The Empire Strikes Back today.
Is that that's a movie?
Very funny.
I mean, let me just go here. Start conference call.
For those listeners who don't know, Katie Menick, Jim Menick's daughter, and I are working on an extremely nerdy project where we're going to create the prequels. Well, not create necessarily, but write the prequels as we feel they should have been.
Okay, enough of that. Chris, are you back?
Chris is
what
back.
What did I miss?
You don't want to know. Okay, so, all right. Well, anyhow, whatever the rationale is for this thing, I'm not going to edit this, so I'm sorry to make people have to sit through John talking about
commercial
interruption. Anyhow, whatever the rationale, I'd be interested, because maybe it's a reason I should change the way I would normally do it, but I'm always going to look at if you lose this round, you're out, is always going to be my first place to look. In any tabbing situation.
I do remember that. I'll find the rationale we'll talk about in a future episode. I remember that Jenny had a very compelling set of reasons why this NDCA term specifically should have. I'll find it. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the other thing we did that was new to me was using the warm room. Okay. And which is fine. You know, it's very, once Beats has done it before and he showed me what to do, it's very simple. And I did it for the PF and we did it for LD. And it's really good because people get notifications and you can track how you're doing and all this sort of thing. But I found out that after the fact that it doesn't, it tells you if you won or you lost, but it doesn't tell you the speaker points. And so I thought this was a mistake. This is a deliberate part of the program that it tells you if you won or lost, but it won't tell you your speaker points. And I got the.
Well, that's not true. I mean,
it does.
That could be a setting, but there have been tournaments in the past where.
Well, apparently they've taken it out. I mean, maybe they. I remember distinctly seeing the points in the past,
and then points on the.
Not for this one.
I think there were points on every round.
There were no points were not shown, and.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe you're right.
Yeah, and apparently, and now I could be. Now, my understanding is that it has been taken out of the program.
Really? Not even an option.
It's not an option that it was taken out at the Joy of Tournaments level for whatever reason. Somebody decided that people shouldn't know what their speaker points are, which I don't.
Well, that's
buy
strange because that should be a tournament director's decision.
Should be at our discretion. And like I said, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we've come to the point where whatever the hell it is that we're doing, this is it. This is how you did. So, I've had people come and say, I didn't give those points. I gave some other points.
Exactly.
It was a low point win or whatever. Now we have no way. Because I'm operating under the assumption that the points were going out. So I didn't post anything because normally I would just post and print it up and paste it on the wall. So, I mean, this is I don't understand what the logic is behind this, why we wouldn't let people have their points.
I understand the logic behind it, but I still don't think that it's...
It should be a discretion. It should be at the discretion of the tournament.
Yeah.
And I understand that there probably will be somebody sitting there in a small field like the NDCA trying to figure out who you're going to hit next. I kind of do understand that, but I still think it's...
Sure, but if they want to... if they want to waste their time that way...
Yeah, if they want to waste their time figuring out who they're going to hit next, I mean, tell you what, if you're doing really well, you're going to hit some good person. And Beats, of course, has the entire USC Law School working with him, but everybody else has,
as they say.
But
not only that, all you have to do is not show the points until you put the pairing out for the next round anyway.
Which I do. I mean, that's because let's put it this way: you don't keep going into the warm room every 2 seconds. What happens is you get all your ballots in, and the last thing you're thinking about is, oh, I better post the warm room. What you're worrying about is getting your preference. Looking at the judges,
it's like
and
the check sheets.
Blah blah blah.
The check sheets usually go up after the next round.
And so after we put the round out, and I think the rules say there has to be a half hour or some ridiculous thing like that between the posting and when the round starts or something, and then we would go into the
That's
warm
not
room
ridiculous.
Thing.
Sorry.
Well, where I come from in Menick time,
there are certain tournaments. I will say this: we talked
Menick time. This
tournament.
Podcast is already over. So
certain tournaments. Well, Menick time is always good because Menick time, in my book, just means you're running ahead of schedule. Although that could be taken to extreme Menick time or like daylight.
There is no – the schedule is we're going to get this round out as quickly as possible.
Sure.
And the time that I put on there is 5 minutes ago.
I think certain tournaments that doesn't work at – and we found that at my own tournament 2 years ago, as you might recall, where there was an issue with the sexto – actually, it was the runoff round, not the sexto dismiss
round. Don't say
it was
that.
Unclear about what the start time was. Because it wasn't announced, and members of a certain school complained, and I think rightfully so, actually.
Well,
I mean, it doesn't have to be 30 minutes. I think 15 minutes for an LD round is frankly sufficient.
Well, there's two different things. I mean, if in fact you have a tournament, I actually agree that there should be enough time. First of all, people are prepping like crazy, which is fine. Also, you have the luxury of time. The tournament is a 3-day tournament. So you do have there's no pressure to get anything done at any particular, I don't remember, oh my God, we're going to, run into the wee hours or anything. So you have the time to do it. So it's okay. But at a normal, not a normal, but at a regular invitational tournament,
sure.
You don't have your 2-day thing and you just, people have to get home.
Well, also certain tournaments, I think we could just be realistic about this, and it doesn't mean that a tournament is good or bad.
No.
Certain tournaments invite more prepping than others.
Yeah, and they, have the luxury of time to do it.
That the tournament that you still haven't blogged about, the Malcolm A. Bump Memorial Tournament, the winner of this year's Tournament Host of the Year.
Yay.
Congratulations to Jim and Hendrick Hudson High School. Mm-hmm. That is a perfect example of a tournament where, as far as I'm concerned, prep between rounds is largely meaningless, and that's not an insult to Bump. It's one of the things I love most about Bump, because you basically know what the judging is going to be in every round, because almost all the judges have virtually identical paradigms, right? Mm-hmm. So the necessity to prep as intensely between rounds, I think, is just not there, right? Or is not there as much. And I think that that's, and it's also on a more limited schedule. It's like a day and a half long tournament, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it is just having, well, to any of these 2-day, you know, you're going to end on Saturday night as compared to, like I was just looking at the schedule for TOC. I mean, we're out of there every day, like at 6. I mean, the worst case scenario was Sunday. I think we're out at 7 or some nonsense like that. Yeah, that's great. I mean, but you have 3 days to do it, and registration is on a fourth day, you know, so there's plenty of time for that. NDC is the same thing. You had plenty of time for that to happen. Anyhow, the point being, so the warm room was very easy to do, and it did a lot of things because it sends out a message to everybody who has given us their phone number. So the kids get to know where they're supposed to go. The judges know where they're supposed to go. That was pretty good. And it was funny, though, because in LD, not everybody had signed up, but almost everybody signed up. In PF, they have no idea what they're doing. You know, like two people signed up, you know.
And, the stereotypes.
It's just they're, the stereotypes are derived from true characteristics. And I don't think that I can't recall. I don't follow PF that much, but I don't know how many tournaments they have where they've had warm room kind of stuff, and somebody's been posting it, you know, religiously.
Yeah, I mean, the Glen Brooks, I think, had a warm room for PF. Well, that might be it.
I mean,
Emory certainly didn't. Emory also didn't have a warm room for LD, even though it had one for policy, but that's a separate.
Didn't it? Yeah, I thought it did.
Nope.
Well, I guess I saw the feature, but I probably never saw the. And so Sophie would just send me updates. But, I mean, it's certainly not hard to do. I mean, if you're going to use Joy of Tournaments, you should have the... And yeah, well, part of it is, too, also having the people being sent far and wide. I mean, we were at University of Scranton, right? And they weren't going far and wide, but they're going to, you know, there's three different buildings. So people would text in the results, which I love, and we would have the things. And then, you know, they could be wherever they are. They're going to get a text message back, say, okay, the round is out. They would have time to go get it. Because they have a half an hour. They would have time to go get their ballots, unless they were one person who will remain nameless, who just said, send me the ballot and a pedicure and, you know, whatever. But everybody else would come and get their ballots. Yeah, so it's a good system. I mean, in the university world, in the world where people are flung out into 7 or 8 buildings or 3 buildings and not the same building as where the ballots are, it's nice to have that kind of electronic thing. But we just use basic old Google Voice for getting the results in from people. And that worked fine. Not for PF, but I realize there's no reason in PF. Why in PF is it important to know what side anyone is on as far as the results are concerned?
I assume it's just for statistical purposes. I mean, the same reason, like, if we never knew...
I'm not going to argue. That's a good point. But, I mean, for most tournaments, you're going to know that. But occasionally, at a tournament like Princeton or, you know, whatever, where you have a lot of PFers and there UPenn, you have a lot of PF and they're scattered to the winds, all they have to do is say, Smith got 28 and Jones got 22 and blah, 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 and Bronx lost or whatever, you know, and then that's all you need to know. And side doesn't matter in terms of tabulation.
And for the purposes of pairing the next round anyway. Yeah. Because you can always just get it off the ballot afterwards.
I guess I agree with the academic argument that you're right, but I also know that there is the data that comes out of tournaments is important in a lot of ways. Like, we wouldn't know.
But that's not, you would still get that. Because
you could get the data. Even if I go, I'll go back and change it if it's that important.
You get it off the ballot afterwards. You just don't need it in the text message.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you just meant generally in terms of recording. I'm sorry.
I could go that far, but I can pair the round and then spend 5 minutes going back into them and making it aff and nay.
That said, though, making the judge say which side is which does sort of serve to jigger the memory of the judge a little bit. So
that becomes a text message prohibitive.
I mean, well, it does, but at the same time, I'm not sure I trust PF judges to say that without thinking hard about who was on which side and at least being prompted that way.
Well, that brings up the other question, which I don't know if you were there when we were talking about it, Chris, but why the hell did we flip the coin in PF?
Oh, I hate that. I think it's the worst thing in the world.
I mean, because we were talking about...
I can tell you exactly why we do that.
A lot of discussion about
Yeah, it's a gimmick. Yeah. Exactly.
It's a gimmick, and it's to prevent prep.
It's a gimmick to prevent prep, but I think it's also a gimmick to, and I say this as somebody who has a huge PF program now. And so I love PF. I mean, we're bringing more PFers to the TOC than our LDers and policy teams combined. We have a policy team, two LDers, and three PF teams. So I am a fan. I think PF, there are a lot of strong points. I do think that the main reason for this coin flip is to pretend that there's strategy in the round, that there's some great strategy about who speaks, you know, who's going to speak first.
Well, actually, I don't mind the coin flip of who speaks first. That sort of adds a little mystery and some fun to it. But the idea of what side you're going to go on, and like as we have said, because we were talking about this, because we're talking about in just the LD side of the coin, we had 7 rounds or 8 rounds. We've talked on the podcast about the bias for negative, and if you have an even number, obviously that bias doesn't matter. So we're talking about all the kind of bias, but then we started talking about, well, you could go in a PF round and only ever run one side and win a tournament.
Yeah, well, this goes to this speaks to the issue that I actually was going to find a way to. This is a nice segue to something I wanted to talk about, which is one issue that we. No, I mean, I wanted to talk about this, about the stuff we're talking about as well. But an issue that I think is important that came out of the NDCA that we haven't really directly talked about yet is the 8-round thing, which was a way to address neg bias issue. And actually, this is not any great secret, the TOC is considering doing the same thing. There have been some discussions about that going back and forth. And I think, I mean, I
do it on Sunday, whatever you do. I got a flight on Monday. just pointing it out.
The Monday rounds will not go later than that. That's not happening. It would only, there'd be no change to the Monday schedule. So, so what am I saying? Lexi Green and I and Beats and Pam Kitty Whitecuff and a couple of other people on the committee have been pretty vocal bouncing around ideas of how you could address these bias issues. One would be, instead of having 7 rounds, you have 6 rounds instead of having 8 rounds and whatnot, but 6 seems too few. And I'm not really a huge fan of cutting rounds out of a tournament when the invitation promises a set number of rounds, particularly when the tournament is expensive.
I have say, though, the, you know, talking to the kids and being on the other side of the equation this weekend, the kids were mostly in favor of having a shorter tournament at NDCA, given the size of the field and the and the nature of the tournament.
My kids have always wanted to have never liked having more rounds. And this came up at Yale, came up here. You're asking the judge. Well, of course, TOC got a billion judges, but most of the time you're asking the judges to really work like crazy, and you're asking the kids. Yeah, you know, it's a lot of adrenaline flowing in them rounds. And now you're going to ask it for a whole other 2 hours. They're going to have to get through that whole thing again. That's an awful lot to ask on this. And I don't know.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. I mean, what I was going to say is that in relation to my own tournament, which has 7 rounds, I talked about this actually with Jim and Beats for a little bit. So,
both of whom, and I don't know if Kaz was there, but the three of us are going to be at least semi-tabbing your tournament.
Semi-tabbing?
Insofar as you might want to have Kaz.
I don't mind telling. I talked about that with her for a while. That's no diss on Cheryl, in case anyone perceives it that way. We're having a very much expanded public forum tournament next year, and we need Cheryl's skill there. I don't know how else to put this without sounding weird. Also, Cheryl's a familiar face to a lot of our alumni who are going to be judging. That's actually the real reason. Mm-hmm. And speaking of alumni, that's the perfect segue into the 7-round thing. So,
segue back to where we were talking about.
So we have...
self-interrupting.
Yes. We have 7 rounds at our tournament. Why? Well, a large part of the reason, this probably shouldn't surprise anyone, is that there's a tradition of having 7 rounds at the tournament. I mean, I think it also makes sense given the size of our field. But... realistically, the 7-round thing is just...
Well, this year, remember, we did 7 rounds and a runoff.
Right, exactly. Okay. And I do want to say that while I know a lot of people think that I'm big on tradition for tradition's sake, and that's probably true with names like Sexto Decimo Finals.
Must you say that over and over again?
Yes, he must.
Tradition is also important, as I've pointed out in other podcasts, for creating an identity for your tournament. And our tournament... as most people can probably guess, given the kinds of awards we give out and the stuff that we do and the people we fly in, we don't really make a profit off the tournament. It's no secret that most of our support comes from the alumni, and our alumni come to the tournament, and then they're generally very happy. And unsurprisingly, I see a strong spike in donations after the tournament. So cutting the seventh round would be very rough for us, because that's sort of what everyone comes to expect at our tournament. It gives it an, I guess.
I can't imagine, but you have the numbers. You can't possibly cut the seventh round. You'd have to add an eighth round.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's too big. So
part of the not wanting only six at NDCA was predicated on the size of the tournament.
Yeah, right, I mean, sure. It was theoretically possible with a runoff to have six and still have it be fair.
Right. And so I had also explored the possibility of maybe doing something along the lines of side equalization in elimination rounds, which I don't know that's ever been done in a...
Okay, but that is built into TRPC, right? Yes. I mean, I remember seeing this there. So now how exactly does that work?
So the idea would be that the computer would determine what side you are due in the elimination round. See, I actually have a sort of a philosophical objection to coin flips in the elimination rounds in general. It has nothing to do with side buys. I've never really understood why, if the event is supposed to be switch side debate, why suddenly we throw that out the window in the most important rounds, the elimination rounds, right? Suddenly, like, the nature of the event changes.
On the other hand, it's difficult because if all the negatives keep winning, you don't necessarily have anybody do anything.
Well, in that case, I mean, I what would happen if, I guess, if the negatives were winning in every single elimination round is that you would get a coin flip, but the coin flip that and the computer would be set to do this. I wouldn't mind doing it in person because I feel like people don't trust when the computer is doing the coin flip, even though that's what it's doing in the odd numbered rounds. But when you flip the coin, instead of flipping who affirms and who negates, it would simply be that the head means the higher seed affirms and the tails means the lower seed affirms.
So they don't get to pick.
Right, so it still wouldn't be active choice kind of thing.
Well, active choice is kind of irrelevant in a world where everybody always picks negative.
Yeah, I mean, it's the six one half dozen another. But the point is, I'm getting back to this. So the computer will somehow sort out that, okay, well, they've had five negs and three afs, so they got to go af.
Right.
And if exactly. It's even, then it flips.
Okay. Then it flips. You know, and the only thing I just want to note is that in this world, Beat suggests, and I think I agree, that in this kind of world, you would clear some of the 4-3s because if you believe that there is such a strong negative bias, which there is, I mean, that's documented, then you would clear some 4-3s to compensate for the people who in round 7 affirmed.
About your tournament, how many 4-3s would that be offhand? You know?
I honestly don't know. I would have to look at the numbers.
Yeah. Well, you're essentially doing a full triple.
No, I don't think that... Well, we'd have to see.
You'd have to have some break point, and it might as well be the whole damn thing, you know, rather than a part. I don't know. Let me see. I mean, how many? I'm using the legendary program here. How many people do you have at your tournament?
I have between 180 and 200. 170 and 200.
Well, let's say 180. So 18. I'll give you 184 people. If you have 7 prelims and you break to triples, 21 4-3s break out of 51.
Ooh, that's tough.
So,
I mean, 4-3, it's kind of if you feel that's unfair, I suppose you'd win another round, right?
Another round, exactly. I would feel very comfortable with that.
That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of 4-3s. I think that's very generous. And the only thing is you have to figure out a way to work it into your schedule because you probably have to do a single flight, just like you have to do the double round single flight.
Don't you feel, though, that in a way that trying to do all this is just papering over the real problem?
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. I don't know how we address the real problem in a timely manner, though.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with what you're saying at all. I would never see this as a permanent fix to anything.
Well, I even go worse. I don't know how we fix the real problem, period.
Yeah, we talked about this. We didn't really come up with some great solution. We talked about all kinds of rough things, but I don't know.
The trouble with having a community that is so all over the place in a lot of ways is you just sort of – you don't have a mechanism of change. Like, there is no way to go about changing an event.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of – we talked about TOC a lot while we were at the NDCA. And talking about the identities of these two tournaments. Then we start talking about, when we start talking about TOC, we talk more about the identity of the national circuit. So there is a national circuit. We all know that. National circuit isn't that big. It's, you know, whatever number of schools. Mm-hmm. And it's a small proportion of LD as a whole. And it's all by itself. I mean, most LDers in the universe have nothing to do with TOC. I mean, they may certainly know about it, but they're not on the track for it. They don't debate like it. It doesn't matter to them in the least. So if TOC did some, we're going to change the world, nobody would care, you know, because they don't hold the reins. If NFL does it, well, they have a much larger number of people, but the people that are doing circuit stuff, if they didn't like that, I don't want to do that, and so forth. I mean, there's just, I don't know how you get anything done.
I don't think that's true about the TOC, honestly. I think that the people who would listen are the tournaments, and then everybody else would follow.
But only the, there, how many tournaments are affected by the TOC?
Yeah, but the thing is,
TOC qualified.
But how many of them are there compared to how many tournaments there are in the universe altogether?
Well, I mean, it's not even how many of them are there. It's how many kids go to them. And once you have that critical mass, I mean, there are kids who go to only one big tournament a year, but that is a big deal to them because it's a big tournament. You know, there are kids that go to Yale and that's it, or go to Harvard and that's it.
Yeah, so if those tournaments are a certain way, the other tournaments they go to would have to
be. They cast a shadow. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
Well, you can even see that. I mean, think about the trickle down. I mean, yes, we're the ones running it, right? But think about things that we pioneered at Bump and Bronx that we now do at the MHL.
Right.
Right. Like, I mean, it's a given. Kids get angry when there aren't check sheets outside.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. 4 years ago, that would have been laughable.
For I know. It's true.
I think it casts a bigger shadow than you suspect. I think it would probably. Mm-hmm. I think is the venue. I don't think the NFL has it, and I don't think that the any other organization has it. But the trouble is the TOC is not a deliberative body. It doesn't have.
No. TOC is a monarchy of some sort. And everybody thinks it's an oligarchy and that they are getting all together.
I prefer the Illuminati. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Star Chamber, whatever you wish to call it.
So but, the TOC has the authority, I feel, but they don't have the structure by which you can actually come to a decision on things like that.
But even so, what decision you come to? I mean, it's not like everybody said, "Well, if only we did this, it would be fine." It's sort of like, I hear about the changes in the timing.
That's the point of having a deliberative body because they make that decision, you know. And
but you're right. They're not that deliberative body. I mean, they're just.
And I wouldn't want the TOC committee to be it because the TOC committee is an unelected little club, and so in a very way, they really are an oligarchy. And, you know, no offense to Cruz or anybody else who's on the committee, that's not how we should be choosing.
I used to be on it. I don't know how I got on it. I don't know how I got off it, you know.
Right.
So,
actually, I do recall my awkward moment where I excitedly told Jim Menick that I was on the committee and I couldn't wait for committee meetings with him. And then I found out I was his replacement. But they have been literally the most awkward thing ever in debate for me. I'm sure
he'll come up with something to best it
eventually. Yeah.
Jim, guess what? Anyway.
I mean, obviously you're not going to pick a panel of people that way and entrust them with the future of the event, but if not them, who else? I don't know.
But that's the thing. There is no deliberative body. I mean, well, the NFL has deliberative bodies, but I don't think they're the right deliberative body.
Yeah.
The closest I could think to something that attempted to have this kind of any kind of change was the Lincoln Douglas Education Project, honestly. I mean, you know.
And that was just Lear raging against the storm. They were reactive, not proactive.
Right.
Well, like I said, unless we have a specific plan that everybody thinks really, really would change things, I don't know. I think that we're sort of stuck with what it is. And I think we do need mechanical means to get past it rather than you know, some kind of, okay, we're going to add another speech, we're going to add more time, or we're going to, you know, make the negative stand on one foot, you know, just not going to do it. I don't know.
That would be fun.
And the other thing is, remember, it's only at certain levels that this comes into play. You know, so at TOC, at NDCA, I would bet there's serious negative bias, whereas at a Bump, for instance, is probably way not as much negative bias because you have a broader field. And, you know, we're just...
I would be interested to actually have you run the data on
Bumble. I did run... When we were talking about this, I ran... Not necessarily on Bumble. What data I ran showed that at you know, like at an MHL, for instance, it made no difference whatsoever. You know, whereas...
But an MHL is fun. An MHL is
okay.
Not.
Well,
yeah.
So I think there's a continuum.
The kid
though.
Who wins is the kid who doesn't wet his pants.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah,
not.
I think
there's a continuum play. Because remember, at Bump, you're going to have people like, let's say, half the field, whatever, is not really in contention to get a bid or to make it to Sundays or whatever. So those people are going to just lose anyhow. When is yeah? So they're always going to lose the preliminary round, which means that the first two rounds. And maybe the third round even is not going to matter so much what side you're on as much as if you're the better debater.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't disagree about that, and I think that's why.
But whereas you go to NDC, it is going to matter what side you're on even in the presets.
Right.
Because I mean, everybody's pretty good.
Right. I mean, that's why at Bronx.
Bronx, same thing. You have a much stronger field.
But Bronx field is huge, so you still have the effect you're talking about, and then that effect starts to go away as you look in the who's still in round five,
right.
Who's still in round six. Who's that's true. I don't.
It's certainly, and it's way true in Elims. Elims was almost a given anywhere, you know. So you had to get to the Elims.
Can I break in for a moment? Can I point out that we've also talked about side bias about the five of the last six podcasts, and perhaps our listeners would appreciate if we had a different discussion today.
Screw them.
Just saying. I feel
they're
like we've
like
gone
paying.
Over this ground about
did
six times.
Did anybody pay you for this podcast? I mean, is it here? Chris, I love
you
your
didn't
podcast.
Get the
here's some
the
money.
Illuminati?
Yeah. Okay, well.
According to Brian Manuel, the real Illuminati are people, and I guess this includes me. I was highly flattered. People who are both on the advisory committee and Barclay Forum key coaches, because the key coach thing gives you like the secret ceremony and stuff.
Yes, where they like, sacrifice the goats, right?
I can't say what we do at the Barclay. but we have like the shawl, or it's not shawls, but whatever they are,
the little pink like scarf things.
Salmon things, and the keys and whatnot. I thought that was kind of a funny.
Oh, if it's any consolation, by the way, Atlas Shrugged is apparently doing as bad as you can do on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes,
I just thought
my,
I would point
headline,
that out.
My headline, I was talking about this with my
was
friend
it out?
Yes.
It's
came out on
I guess it's out.
No, it's
it
out.
Did?
Came out on
I don't remember seeing any reviews of it anywhere. I just remember reading this.
As I said to my friend Mike, he is not a debate person, but he'll be thrilled to hear he's on this podcast. I'll tell him. I said that if I were writing this for my school newspaper, because I used to write really sassy headlines for film reviews, mine would be Audience Shrugged. It doesn't seem like anyone's here for this film. Well, and I send my regrets to the lapsed objectivist of the debate community, Aracelis Beale, the director of debate at the Collegiate School, who I'm sure is very upset that, well, actually, she probably doesn't care. But anyway.
Well, I got to say that the trailer just looked like, I mean, it's a movie
film?
About two assholes in a train. I mean, really, what's the draw, you know?
But so. Also looked like it was like a trailer that somebody uploaded to YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
It looked like a fake film.
It did not look real, but I mean, the book doesn't sound. I mean, I didn't read. I had an audio book, and it's like a 77 discs. I mean, the thing is just endless,
actually,
right? And I listened to the whole thing.
I'm gonna top Chris Palmer, but okay, go Chris Palmer, and then I'm gonna top you, and I'm gonna make.
Yeah, I read the whole thing. I have this unfortunate propensity sometimes of like I have a when I start a book, I have this burning need to finish it. No
you can't
how
have
bad
my
it is.
Job, you know.
Boy, Atlas Shrugged really tested that too.
Oh
like
yeah,
a,
57
that,
page speech or whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it's like a 70 page monologue in the middle, which is essentially an essay. He just lays out the precepts of objectivism, I guess, and for whatever it is, it's fine, but. But yeah, it's just like, dear Lord, and the most disturbing sex scenes I think I've ever read in literature.
You have to watch the movie of The Fountainhead if you want
to
see.
No, you need to watch
the YouTube
clip The Fountainhead in 5 seconds, which is one of the funniest of that little meme online.
Watching the whole Fountainhead movie. I mean, it is so appallingly bad that it's really, really good. You know, I mean, it's just like, oh my God, this is just terrible. You're just rolling in the eye. I've always maintained it would be the best HI ever to do The Fountainhead.
Jonathan Chavez would cut it too, let me tell you.
There is good material in there. You know, Howard Roark. Oh my God. Ellsworth Dewey.
That's the greatest villain name of all time. Don't, with the possible
it is a pretty good name. I mean, I do like that name.
Dewey.
That's true. Wow.
What are we talking about? Here? People have definitely switched to their Kylie Minogue playlist at this point, because I know I will when I'm listening to this on the subway.
Except that you're the only person who has a Kylie Minogue.
Yeah, I don't have one. I don't know. Sorry. Okay.
All right,
getting back to business. No side.
I would just like to inform the debate audience that that is what I'm doing the day after the TOC, is going to a Kylie Minogue concert in Manhattan. It will be wonderful. And now there's silence in the song.
Boy,
the crickets, sir.
Just when I think I've reached the end of the astonishment that it's proved, something like that pops out. And...
God, anyway. Oh, whatever.
Of course, you are the guy who missed a Lexington tournament once to go see Bette Midler with your mother.
And I also, it wasn't with my mother, it was with my aunt. And when I met her, I was so starstruck, I didn't know what to say. And I just blurted out that she was the greatest woman who ever lived. And then she looked at me and she said, "Well, I'm not," which was very nice. Thank you anyway.
And Vassar,
then,
huh?
That was all I could get out. Yeah, it was pretty Vassar.
Okay.
We have just flown off the reservation.
I have
today.
A question. Getting back onto target, how does
to talk for 32 minutes? It feels like four.
How does NDC?
It feels like I could have ended the Atlas Shrugged read in here. Okay, anyway, sorry.
How does NDCA establish who goes to the tournament? What is the?
Complicated formula, I believe.
How does it work? I mean, I really don't know, because I had two kids who are obviously going to be qualified, so I didn't pay that much attention to it. But what is the formula?
But increasingly, it's automated, so you don't really have to worry about doing it, because the calculations are really annoying. The basic idea is that it takes into account the strength of the competition and diversity of states at each tournament. So instead of something like, I'll use Bronx as an example. Like Bronx is an octas bid for the TOC, right?
Yeah.
I guess it would still theoretically be, you know, even if like 25 people showed up, it would be an octas bid, right? So the NDCA tournament instead doesn't have a set, like you don't have to reach a set round specific tournaments. Any tournament could theoretically give you enough points to qualify.
And what are points based
on? Yeah, based on what?
They're based on how far you made it at the tournament, the strength of the competition at the tournament, and the diversity of states at the tournament. So you get a certain number of points at, let's say, like the vanilla tournament, the basic tournament, right? And then the more and more difficult the competition is, the higher and higher the points become as you reach certain
levels. And how do you measure the strength of the competition?
Let me pull up the exact calculator here. A lot of it has to do with geographic diversity, which I sort of agree with Beats is perhaps not the the end all be determinants. Let me pull this
up. It has a I can understand a certain intuitive sort if people of. Traveled far, it must be worth the trip.
True, but I mean I have to say I am sympathetic to the argument that five states in the Northeast is not the same thing as five states on the West Coast, and I do understand that argument.
I do too.
California
is
basically multiple states, so it's a little ridiculous that all right, so here we go. So the way that it works is that there are you first calculate the size of the tournament up to 80 teams. Now this is actually kind of interesting that it ends at 80 teams, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that policy tournaments just tend to be smaller than LD tournaments. Not always, but I noticed that because it used to be up to 100 teams. So it's the number of teams attending the tournament times a diversity of tournament multiplier, so how many states were there, times an elimination round success multiplier times the preliminary round win percentage. So actually the exact strength, it's not determined by the strength of the competition. That's something that I was conflating that with something that Beats and I proposed about doing, like a chess-like rating for debate. But that's the way that the NDCA tournament works. So the idea is that even if it doesn't calculate for the exact strength of the tournament, it calculates still for the size of the tournament and diversity of the tournament on a rolling basis as opposed to some list that's set out at the beginning of the year.
Which, when you think about it, is relatively reasonable.
Do I like being able to say that my tournament has an octus bid? Sure, I'm not going to lie. I do like that. But I don't think that that's – I also appreciate the argument that that's just a designation given by somebody else, right? Whereas this tournament actually rewards for the actual strength of the tournament.
Yeah, because you would have a big number for states because you get a lot of people from all those states.
Right. I mean, we were a maximum point qualifier for the tournament. We had more than 15 states. We had more than 80 kids. Mm-hmm. A lot more kids.
Yeah. So. Although that number, I mean, seems to be it ought to just be whatever it is. I mean, if you have 10,000 kids, then that should be 10,000. Honestly, why it's limited.
I kind of don't disagree, but I remember there was a discussion about why there was a cap, and I feel like it had to do with the idea that that there's an argument to be made that after a point you get diminishing returns in terms of the size of your field, like the Harvard tournament.
But I don't know if there are that many good debaters out there. Yeah.
I mean, that may be true. At any one tournament, diminishing returns.
And I hesitate to bring this up because I think that sometimes people fairly or unfairly feel that the NDCA has like a policy bias. But I do know that one reason that we brought up that the size of the tournament isn't always the best determinant is that NBA is the example of why a small tournament shouldn't necessarily be penalized. I mean, for those LD listeners who aren't familiar with the NBA tournament and just really know the NBA round robin, the NBA tournament and policy debate, each school can only send its top team. So there's no – it used to be a touch that I used to like is that I remember sometimes seeing schematics that said instead of, for example, Bronx Science EM for Elias and Markov, you might have a schematic that just says Bronx Science because there's no other team from Bronx Science there, right? And so the idea would be that each school can only send its A team. And so the tournament is small because not that many schools are invited to go to this tournament, right? But it becomes an insanely difficult tournament.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, every round – I will say that on some level it felt harder than the TOC. It just felt like every round was ridiculously hard. So so there is something to be said that having this built-in size of tournament doesn't always work. But – as Beats and I, and we've talked about this in other podcasts, unless you had something like what chess has, like the ELO rating, I don't really know how else you would determine size. Oh, Chris Palmer vanished.
He's gone.
Disgusted by my cut.
He just went home. He was already home. All right.
Well, that's just awkward.
Well, just keep going.
I don't know what else to say about that. It's just, I think the only way you could really measure strength of competition directly would be if you had an ELO style head-to-head ranking system the way that chess does, which I think is an awesome idea, an awesome goal. It would be incredibly time consuming. Mm-hmm. And whereas I was once known perhaps for having nonstop time to do like debate history stuff like that. I mean, Bill Batterman has so far surpassed me in terms of statistical.
Yeah, he's worse than you are.
But not only is he worse than I am, we both agreed that in order to do something like this kind of ranking system, you need somebody even worse than the two of us. Mm-hmm. Oh, Bill Batterman is I am in awe of Bill Batterman. He is ridiculous. Yeah, so,
On that note, we've lost Palmer because he didn't pay his internet
right,
bill.
We're down to two. Okay.
We're down to seeds and stems with the two of us here talking about the same old crap over and over again.
Okay, I have a request. After the TOC, and it will be inappropriate perhaps for the tone of the podcast, but I would like the music to be Kylie Minogue in honor of the concert that I'm going to.
Well, you just have to give me one of her. I've never heard this woman.
So. What? Yes, you have.
No, I haven't.
Kylie Minogue? Oh, yeah. Come on.
What? I have no Kylie Minogue album.
How about the Locomotion from the 80s? Her cover? It's like one of the best-selling versions.
She's no Little Eva, as far as I'm concerned.